When I am among the trees, especially the willows and the honey locusts, equally the beech, the oaks and the pines, they give off such hints of gladness. I would almost say that they save me, and daily. I am so distant from the hope of myself in which I have goodness and discernment, and never hurry through the world, but walk slowly and bow often. Around me the trees stir in their leaves and call out, "Stay a while." The light flows from their branches and they call again, "It's simple." "It's simple," they say, "and you too have come into the world to do this, to go easy, to be filled with light and to shine." So the Sufis polish their heart to reflect the light of the Beloved into the world. And the Buddhas said, "Bhikkhus, there are four radiances. What are the four? The radiance of the moon, the radiance of the sun, the radiance of fire, and the radiance of wisdom. Bhikkhus, radiance of wisdom is most excellent." So radiant mind is unfindable and undefinable. It's clear and reflective. The Tibetans call it mani, the diamond jewel of awareness. Suzuki Roshi said, "Big mind is something to express, not something to figure out. Big mind is something you have, not something you seek for." So light is the sun and warmth of our heart and the wisdom of our being. And as we grow older, we're supposed to be getting wiser, but some of us aren't sure that that's happening. But we know it when we see it. Someone who, as Mary Oliver said, goes easily and bows often. Someone who's unperturbed by what the Buddhists call the eight vicissitudes of life. I always have to read them. Gain and loss, fame and defame, praise and blame, and happiness and pain. So what throws us off from this equipoise a lot is this is change, which in the Taoist Buddhist tradition is not seen as a march toward death, but the affirmation of the ever-flowing life force. And Pema Chodron says, "When things fall apart, and we think the point is, when things fall apart, we think the point is to pass the test or to overcome the problem. But the truth is that things don't really get solved. They come together and they fall apart." They come together and they fall apart again. It's just like that. The wisdom comes from letting there be room for all of this to happen, room for grief and for relief, for misery and for joy. Another thing that throws us off, of course, is our preferences. I think we all know, many of us have heard what the Zen patriarch said, the way is easy for those who do not pick and choose. Our Hazrat Anayat Khan said, "You can have all good things, wealth, friends, kindness, love to give, love to receive, once you have learned not to be blinded by them, learn to escape from the disappointment and the repugnance that things are not what you want them to be." And that goes for ourselves. How many of you don't always think you're what you want you want yourself to be? Tara Brach calls it in the Western world the trance of unworthiness, the trance of not enoughness. And it seems to be a particular problem endemic to our modern Western culture. When the lamas came to this country to teach, it took them 20 years to figure out what that was. They just didn't even understand it. I don't think they understood it until Western teachers themselves had trained long enough to explain it to them. So what we need most of all is a heavy dose of maitri, loving kindness toward ourselves. And we need to understand that we are not responsible for the results of our actions. That's Krishna told Arjuna on the battlefield, be devoted to me, do the best you can, but leave the results up to me. The results are up to me, rather. So when we have this reactivity and then we have our story on top of it, that we have been bad for our own reactivity, Pema Chodron calls this the squeeze. When we find ourselves in this, it's because we're taking too much credit for what's arising. What's arising is because of a myriad of causes and conditions and component parts. And our little tiny bit of free will has such a small part in whatever arises, ever. So when we take all that responsibility, we're really, we're in ignorance. And arrogance, really. It's a much bigger picture. But some of the conditioning that is going into that is our animal conditioning, the reptilian brain that we're wired to see everything as other and to protect ourselves so that we won't be others' next meal. But back to this Western conditioning, our parenting has become in the last century a bit peculiar, taken away as an infant, slapped on the backside, and then put in a separate room when it's easy enough to monitor the anxiety and the heartbeat of a baby in another room as opposed to a baby who's lying on its mother's breast. And then some of us... I wasn't even nursed, and then I was fed on a Spock schedule. I think we've grown out of that, but some of us in this room were fed on schedules, so that when we cried, we were not fed. Mm-hmm. So we were given the message that our hunger wasn't okay, our emotions mm-hmm. weren't okay, our crying wasn't okay. So for some reason, Westerners have gotten a heavy dose of this conditioning of not being quite okay. So it's something that we have in our dharma. It's our special dharma to work with here in the modern Western world. And then we also have the distractions and the addictions that we turn to because there's some uncomfortable feeling of not quite being enough. And we turn to these for self-soothing. It's understandable. It's understandable. That's what I'm trying to say, is that we should become interested. What is going on? What is the conditioning that's happening here? Rather than than thinking that there's something wrong with us. So if we can say what's happening here, it does remind me of a teaching story that Wali Ali likes to tell, and so I'm sure a lot of you have heard it, but I'm going to tell it. Moses is going up to the mountain every day to talk to God, and can you hear me? And there's the most perfect practitioner there at the foot of the mountain every morning. He's there at 4 a.m. and he has a long, long white beard that shows how wise he is. And he does his practices perfectly every day. And one day he says, "Moses, when you're up there, will you ask God how I'm doing?" "Yeah, sure." Well, Moses forgets. He's about to turn around and come back down. God says, "Hey, remember, tell that guy down there that he's always thinking about his beard." So Moses comes down the mountain. He's already forgotten. He's starting to go home. And the guy says, "Hey, Moses, what did God say?" He said, "Oh, he said you're always thinking about your beard." The guy says, What? You know? And he says, "Oh, no, it's not true." And he begins to pull out his beard one hair at a time. And the next morning when Moses goes up, he's pulling out the last hairs and his face is all bloody. And, that day when he's leaving, God says, "What I tell you?" He's always thinking about his beard. So we want to ask what's happening here rather than get contracted, fixated on a sense of self when we're not feeling so good about ourselves. And we want to be able to sort of stay with that feeling of discomfort. Trungpa calls it leaning into the sharp points. We want to just kind of stay with it and see what it really is. So rather than try to obliterate and exterminate any feelings that we think aren't so healthy, we're much better off just trying to get to know them. Jung said, we do not become enlightened by imagining figures of light. We become enlightened by bringing consciousness to the darkness. So we want to integrate the light states that we know in these moments. We want to bring them into our daily lives and into the dark places. So Sarah mentioned this poem from Rumi today, and basically gave the same message that I'm giving tonight. Here is the poem from Rumi. "This being human is a guest house, every morning a new arrival, a joy, a depression, a meanness. Some momentary awareness comes as an unexpected visitor. Welcome and entertain them all, even if they are a crowd of sorrows who violently sweep your house empty of its furniture. Still, treat each guest honorably. He may be clearing you out for some new delight. The dark thought, the shame, the malice, meet them at the door laughing and invite them in. Be grateful for whatever comes, because each has been sent as a guide from beyond." Thich Nhat Hanh says, "Serve them a cup of tea." He says, "Welcome them, serve them tea. Hello, goodbye. I know you, I'm familiar with you." So as the more familiar we get with these states, the easier they are to simply accept and watch them as they appear and then fade away. This watching and of the appearance is what the Tibetans talk about when they say Om Mani Padme Hum. The mani is this awareness, and the Padme or the Padma is the symbol of material nature, what the Tibetans call apparent reality. It's always changing, it's ephemeral. But it surely is there for us to taste, to touch, to smell, and to feel. And so this meeting place then, in Sanskrit, a meeting place of two worlds is called a tirtha. And usually when one goes on pilgrimage, they go to a tirtha. So our pilgrimage is moment to moment to arrive at this meeting place between our awareness and what appears in this vastness. And to know our situation is to settle back in the awareness and not identify with what appears. Because when we do that, if our emotions go up, we go up. If our thoughts go down, we go down, and we are on a roller coaster. But if we know ourselves to be situated back here in this place of pure awareness, then we can welcome what appears in this field and watch it as it disappears. The eye is a good metaphor for that awareness. We could say the eye of awareness. The eye is like that. We don't look at our eye. We look out. And yet we know that we have the eye by what is reflected back to it. So we infer the awareness that we carry, the center of our being. We infer it through what is reflected back to us. But we have to always remember that both are present in this interdependent moment, this Om Mani Padme Hum. It's not what's arising, but it's what's arising and how it's being perceived. It doesn't matter what we are aware of. It doesn't matter what happens. It only matters that we are aware of it. If we're dwelling in the awareness, then anything that arises in that way is understood in terms of its beginning, middle, and end, and its interdependence. And that is why the wise ones come to these places where fame and defame are the same to them, because they're situated in awareness. I think Hazard and Nayak Khan said, "This is the breath that counts." So it's now. That's Om Mani Padme Hum. And Thich Nhat Hanh says, "If I'm doing the dishes to do something else, life isn't worth living." And in fact, it's not being lived. It can only be lived if we are there present. I'm sure I said it last year, just like in Las Vegas, you must be present to win. The sublime is beyond concept and word, but it's only ever known in the pulsing heart of the here and now. Lala says, "I was passionate, filled with longing. I searched far and wide, but the day the truthful one found me, I was home." And Sam Lewis says that the purpose of the main teaching for all dancers is to find the center of their own being. So I just like to read something from Krishnamurti as a closing. I'm going to put my glasses on because I can't see very well. "To be aware is to watch your bodily activity, the way you walk, the way you sit, the movements of your hands. It is to hear the words you use, to observe all your thoughts, all your emotions, all your reactions. It includes awareness of the unconscious with its traditions, its instinctual knowledge, and the immense sorrow it has accumulated. Not only personal sorrow, but the sorrow of man. You have to be aware of all of that, and you cannot be aware of it if you are merely judging, evaluating, saying, this is good and this is bad, this I will keep and I will reject this, all of which makes the mind dull and insensitive. Attention flows from awareness when it is that awareness, there, when in that awareness there is no choice, no personal choosing, just observing and experiencing. You must have in the mind a great deal of space, a mind that is caught in ambition, greed, envy, in the pursuit of pleasure and self-fulfillment, with its inevitable sorrow, pain, despair, and anguish. Such a mind has no space in which to observe and to attend. It is crowded with its own desires, going round and round in its own backwaters of reaction. You cannot attend if your mind is not highly sensitive, sharp, reasonable, logical, sane, and healthy, without the slightest shadow of neuroticism. The mind has to explore every corner of itself, leaving no spot uncovered, because if there is a single dark corner in one's mind, which one is afraid to explore, from that springs illusion. It is only in the state of attention that you can be a light unto yourself, and then every action of your daily life springs from that light. Every action, whether you are doing your job, cooking, or going for a walk, mending clothes, or what you will. This is the whole process of meditation. Thailand, I was once in a temple that was built around a very giant Buddha that for some reason, for many years, it was not a particularly attractive Buddha, but it was one that was for some reason a site of pilgrimage. And one day, the monks were up on a scaffold cleaning this clay Buddha, and there were beginning to be cracks, and they shined a light in, a flashlight, into the crack. And there, reflecting back, was gold, luminous gold. The Buddha had been covered over to save it from waves of invaders. So that is the metaphor I'd like to leave us all with tonight, is that we are uncovering this, taking this clay off. Inside is this pure, luminous mind, this brilliant mind. If we can take care of that, if we can realize that, everything else will take care of itself. If we can put that desire above all other desires, everything else will take care of itself. Shabda suggested that I ask if anybody has any questions.
I'm going to tell you my first interview with Murshid Sam. It was at he had a home in Novato called the Garden of Anayat where he lived. I had an appointment to see him, and I came to the door and knocked. Welcomed me in very cordially. How are you? So nice to see you. Come into my office. We sat down together, and he said, "And why did you come to see me?" So I said, "Well, Murshid, you know, I don't have any questions. I just felt like I was supposed to come see you." So, in his bold fashion, didn't say another word. He stood up. He said, "Well, thank you very much for coming to see me then." And he walked out. So the next time I came for an interview, you're sure that I had written down a list of questions. I got in touch with my question. And I always find that the question period is some of the richest time of a dialogue. an opportunity to receive guidance and teachings for all of us. So I'll just close one more time if there are any questions.
How do you stay present with just craziness? And, you know, the external world, the internal world.
You go into your senses. You feel. You get out of your thoughts and you feel. You feel your breath. You feel the contraction in your throat. You feel what's happening. You're lost in thought. And these emotions, they have physical sensations. A component of them is their physicality. So you feel the emotion. You don't think about what the cause of it was or what's making you feel that way. You feel what you're feeling.
Mind numbing?
Is that what you said?
Yeah, or, you know, there's a certain kind of numbness.
It's a narrow track awareness, and if you're really aware, you're developing an alertness, like a cattle tick ready to jump onto a cow. You're really awake.
A cattle
tick ready to jump. You're awake and you're sensing everything. And the dullness...
We could relate to that.
And the dullness is something else. In the Buddhist tradition, it's called sloth and torpor. It is a step after, as Shabda has explained, this settling in and relaxing into our breath is a wonderful feeling of relaxation. And it's at that point that we can drift off into this dull mind. And so it just means we're not so aware when that's happening. So we have to find some way to get more, to bring more energy into our meditation, to not dull out like that. And then when that's happening too, then usually the pictures start coming, this kind of waking dream state. And the monks call that going to the movies, and it is wonderful. But it's a tip-off that you're kind of... at that point, you can...
Crosstown buses. Yeah.
Well, it's... No, you're not lost in restless thinking. You're in a really nice state. I know, because I dwell here a lot. it looks like you're meditating, but you're really not. But at that point, you should open your eyes, or you should stand up, or just take a few deep breaths, get engaged again with what's happening. Are you asking what is the relationship to passion and drifting off? I didn't. They seem like opposites.
Yeah. Or is single-minded focus of meditation of present moment awareness seems to not have passion.
Yeah. Okay. I thought that's what you meant.
And also, how to bring that into everyday life.
Passion.
Meditation, he was asking about. He's asking about how to bring meditation into everyday life.
Well, I'm not sure. Are you saying that if you're afraid that if you get if you're dwelling in pure awareness, you won't be very passionate?
Well, I I'm trying to reconcile that passion and stillness.
Well, someone today, I don't remember who it was, it may have been Shabda, said, somebody said, we don't really know much about what bliss is, Ananda. Who said that? Was it you? And what people don't know is when you're in this awake state of pure awareness, everything is vivid and satisfying. It is so alive. It's a state of complete awareness. There is nothing more blissful, and it is peaceful.
It seems a little like passion is more on the outside, the result of obtaining that experience. When one moves back to reality, you know, like passion seems connected to desire, it seems to action, but it seems more articulated than the grandness of the space of whole day.
Mm-hmm.
Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm. I think so.
And we have to speak to aspiration for benefit, pure
benefit
passion.
Of all.
Yeah, pure.
You speak to it.
No, I love what you're speaking to. But,
well, I'm not sure what you're after.
I hear the word passion coming out, and from my own point of view, without a wish, there's no life. There's no life without a wish. So you need passion simply to be alive. But now you have to develop your passion, or if you like to use a different word, aspiration. And so as Darvish has said, dedicate your whole life to the aspiration, to the awakening, to limitless freedom for the benefit of all sentient beings, which is the nature of limitless freedom. Its only wish is to pour bliss on everything. And I think you pointed out the danger with a wish is we base our happiness on the outcome of our wishes. So that's the enemy, not the wish. Make a wish. Wish for what you want. Keep refining your wishes. Make your wishes as much as you can to realize there's your potential wants to be realized. It is your destination. You can't avoid it. So then when you realize that this is what the path of life is, then it dedicates your whole self to awakening that potential of your being. Be passionate about it, but relaxed. Because if you lean too heavily on passion, you get heated up. If you lean too heavily on being equanimity or contentment with what's arising, you could become complacent. So you keep after being an alchemist between the two. Whatever arises, make friends with it. Take it out to tea, like Darvish suggested. Get to know yourself. Make friends with your life. Make friends with the enemy. But be passionate for the goal. Never lose your passion. Be tremendously passionate. Nyogen, when he's writing about meditation, he says, have that wish to be aware so strong that you would bite an iron ball with your teeth on till your teeth, you know, were crushed by the iron ball. He's talking about that much
his
passion.
He's Japanese Zen master.
They're crazy. So aspiration, yes, aspiration, passion. Be passionate for life. Be passionate in everything you do and relaxed about the outcome.
Just to repeat, this passion for life, you have to be present, to alive in that moment with your awareness there. If that isn't passion and if that isn't aliveness, It's the only real aliveness, and a lot of the rest of it is a yes. It's we're kidding ourselves. We're not really alive. We're only alive if we're really present.
Darvesha, thank you so much. thank you. Okay, let's form some circles.